Welcome to Modern Practice. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Villanueva. And on this episode is part two of our series on transformation of healthcare in the post-pandemic era. Joining me again is Selena Burns to guide us in our discussion. Selena, let's talk about provider compensation. What are the issues that get in the way from the provider's perspective?
It's been really interesting to watch the acquisition activity in the market. As we've seen, there isn't a market in the country where health systems haven't been on an aggressive real estate acquisition track, hence those cranes you referenced earlier. And then secondarily, in parallel, acquiring practices, physician practices, in a rather aggressive manner. So as I was referencing earlier, 20 years ago, 80 to 90% of the market was independent practicing. And today we see, conversely, almost 100% of physicians in many markets are employed by the hospital. And while the compensation methodology seems to be in alignment, so the fair market compensation valuations seem to be operating at the right level in most markets, what is out of check and out of sync is the productivity levels. So when getting into these contracts, what it appears to be from our vantage point, that in many instances, there may not have been enough rigor and discussion with physicians when entering into these practices about what the productivity expectations were. So it's not uncommon to see a physician practice today that is operating at the 50th percentile in compensation, but 25th in productivity. And there are a lot of reasons for that. You just referenced one key one, and that is when one is expected to wear multiple hats in administration and clinical documentation, those activities, as you know well as a physician, take away from quality time with patients. So there's an opportunity really to right size, if you will, the productivity support, and at the same time, engage in a different level of joint level partnership at the hospital level with the physicians that are employed so that there's stronger engagement in that productivity equation.
Thank you for that feedback. One thing I do see is that pretty much what you mentioned, that the engagement component with your physicians groups are going to be very important. How's your governance with this? Are you aligning what you're doing with what the strategy of the organization is? I actually think when we deal with many of our members, there's a complete disalignment with the compensation model and the corporate strategy, if you will.
Yeah, and I think that some of that is driven by the fact that the contracts were entered into, but nothing really changed in the relationship. We see the contracts have existed for now a good 5 years, and yet it still feels like physicians are operating as subcontractors in that independent practicing capacity rather than as part of a larger whole as an employee. So the employee engagement, in the same way that we need it to be alive, well, and healthy in corporate America, the same applies within the medical community. And I think that's where one of the biggest opportunities are, because nothing really changed after those employment contracts were executed. So tremendous opportunity for upside engagement between hospital administration and physicians.
Yeah. Are there other ways we can drive quality and safety, or does it always have to be the carrot or the stick?
I think that the drive, again, to lower cost sites of care is going to automatically necessitate efficiencies. We're not going to be able to continue to do more with more. It's how do we do more and do it better from a clinical outcomes perspective in a lower operating expense models. And inherently, that organic movement toward lower cost sites of care, I think, will drive better outcomes, not just from a financial perspective, but also clinical.
On the previous episode, we spoke about how ambulatory care is going to be the most predominant form of care or even some of your revenue cycle. And for a clinical leader, where greater amounts of emphasis is going to be placed. So what is the care access going to be looking like?
Great question, and really timely, because you've probably heard the buzzword convenience care. Mm-hmm. And so as the market is moving in an accelerated pace in ambulatory and virtual, I've been saying the clinical world will become more flat in virtual. If I can't access virtual care in my own community here shortly, there's not probably going to be many barriers to accessing primary care, as an example, in another market, and if access is not available in my own backyard. So convenience care is going to become really prevalent. The vertically integrated health plans, those health plans that have moved into the care delivery space, such as Aetna with the CVS Health model and MinuteClinic, along with Walmart, who just completed piloting 2 10,000 square foot health hubs, which do everything from primary care to dental to lab, radiology, etc. They just recently announced announced that they're going to deploy that model using the same real estate footprint that they used in their retail store footprint. So with everyday low prices that are cost transparent. So as we see more of that model becoming ubiquitous in markets across the country, obviously that's going to change patient expectations and demand for different types of convenience care that can be accessed virtually or conveniently in a MinuteClinic type of environment for primary care and chronic disease management.
I definitely think that the word we're hearing here is the importance about convenience of care. Using, for example, OpenTable, which even as little as 10 years ago is something we never heard of, and pretty much how everybody gets a reservation moving forward.
Yeah, it's a little like Instacart, probably not going away anytime soon, along with curbside delivery.
Yeah. So when we talk about the regulatory burdens, it's usually been brought upon providers and health organizations, but not so much with the payers. Coming from your background and the payer sites, do you see that actually changing?
Well, there is going to be a shift, and the shift has already been in play for several years now, and it's in some ways surprising to me, given my payer background, that it hasn't gotten a little more airtime. But the reality is, on the heels of the Affordable Care Act, there were really two missions. Most of us think of the Affordable Care Act as expanding coverage for the uninsured, and that certainly was one of the motivations. But the second one was disintermediate health plans by creating tax incentives for a larger swath of the commercial employer segment to go self-funded. So to be the risk manager. When I got into the industry on the health plan side of the equation 25 years ago, 85% of the market was fully insured and the risk was held by the insurance company. Today, 85% of the market risk is held by the employer in a self-funded capacity. So as these employers gain more visibility into the cost equation, both from a cost and charges transparency perspective, as well as what is driving the cost from a disease management perspective, we're seeing increased interest in direct-to-employer related models. And I'm hearing about those and getting asked more questions about those every week, Tom. Particularly in the last 8 months. So I do think the pandemic has created some visibility around not only the need to change operating model, but also go-to-market strategies. And when we see every nickel squeezed, the question then becomes, is there a meaningful role of the middleman in the form of the payer that we think of as the health plan, who now really has claim administration responsibility and administration roles that don't necessarily drive the improvement in the clinical cost equation? So increasingly, there seems to be an accelerated interest. And we've already seen a little of that. Walmart leading the charge again in direct-to-employer for spinal surgery centers of excellence, mainly because they weren't seeing the return on investment through the health plan in that particular very expensive, high volume service line.
Yeah, that goes back to the pandemic really brought to light some of our industrial dirty little secrets. So let's go back to workforce. Many of us envision actually calling 2021 the year of the clinical workforce. And you hear statistics that we've lost practically 500,000 women in the healthcare industry due to the pandemic. And there's multiple reasons behind that. We also see that 30% of the physician pool is over the age of 65. And even though some of the most recent information I'm getting is that less people are actually interested in clinical leadership. So how important is addressing all these and even addressing succession planning, which I don't think is something that we see very commonly in many of our healthcare organizations?
Well, on that positive note, I guess we do have conflating headwinds in workforce. The pandemic certainly did not help. And I, in the last several weeks, have had exposure through various presentations conducted virtually, exposure to 60 CEOs and CFOs in the last several weeks, and down to a member, all have communicated concerns around the workforce reductions experienced by people who are at the front line. This pandemic, unfortunately, is going to cause them to hit the pause button and evaluate other career opportunities. So the pandemic definitely is going to have a negative sentinel effect incrementally on nursing shortages, as an example. At the same time, as you pointed out, Tom, the physicians who are retiring and their lifespan of their career is decidedly likely longer than the physicians that are coming out of school, as you know.
Right.
And so this is where, going back to what you had teed up earlier, the whole issue around creating multidisciplinary care teams is going to be critically important, spanning physician assistants, advanced nurse practitioners, a behavioral health support, because we see in the pandemic that the need for behavioral health, which we've all known has been a woefully under-addressed area that arguably not only contributes to outcomes in recovery with chronic disease, but also in wellness.
Let's close things off by talking about social determinants of health. Beforehand, I believe we all felt it was something that we needed to do for our organizations, but I actually think that from the pandemic, we've learned that this is key to strategy moving forward. What are your thoughts behind that?
So when thinking about operating model redesign and where do hospitals need to be in the 2.0 version of themselves as they evolve here between now and the next 5 years, there's really three areas. We've covered a couple of them, one being convenience care models need to be or have an opportunity to be developed at the next level in the ambulatory footprint, as well as with various home care delivery models, be it hospital at home, palliative care, et cetera. Secondly, would be in the digital space. So that's everything from virtual to artificial intelligence monitoring at home, so remote patient monitoring. Thirdly, would be in the area you just keyed in on. We're currently in a healthcare model that really addresses illness. We address issues when they come up episodically as opposed to proactively in wellness and proactively in addressing the gaps in care that are driven by socioeconomic disparity. Those will be, I think, a big part of what's going to have to change, and where there's opportunity for positive change, where hospitals start to be seen as embedded in the community in a way that's not one of just you're there when I need you in an emergent situation, but you're equally there across the continuum of care in wellness and in the community, addressing some of the disparities in chronic disease management, as an example, due to both racial as well as socioeconomic inequity. You can't argue that we're not at an interesting inflection point in the industry, and I do think it presents tremendous opportunity to create a more robust healthcare delivery that is addressing the total continuum of care for families and individuals.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. Honestly, when you look at all the opportunities, we could very well be in a healthcare renaissance if we really want to make it happen.
Yes, and I feel compelled to lastly mention that the other thing that this presents opportunity in, and I am happily hearing a lot of engagement in patient experience. So as we, again, think about operating model design, much of the energy is also here recently, very recently, being focused on patient experience measures and ensuring patient experiences is positive from both a retention as well as new patient acquisition standpoint is something that really didn't get any airtime up until really the last 12 months.
Yeah, actually, if we've learned something that's important to deal with is if you don't have a patient and family advisory committee, you should definitely get one. You actually save several hundreds of thousands of dollars in consultation by just listening to your patients.
Yeah, absolutely.
Selena, we've reached the end of this episode. Thanks for taking time to join us in this series. It's really been a great discussion. And to our listeners, join us for other Modern Practice podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. Also, listen and subscribe to SG2 Perspectives, the podcast on the latest in healthcare strategy. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks for listening.